Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning in for our third podcast recording today. We are going to be discussing chronic venous thromboembolism, really focusing on those management issues and potential long-term complications. My name is Jory May. I am an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And I'm joined by two guests today. I'll mention that we have all decided we're going to be using our first names throughout the podcast, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. So, Bill, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, hi. I'm Bill Braun. I'm the pharmacy coordinator within BayCare Health Systems, and I'm also an assistant professor at the University of Florida as well.
Wonderful. Great to have you, and great to have a pharmacist perspective here.
Thanks.
And Stefan, a little bit about you as well.
Yeah, thank you, Jory. I'm Stefan Moll. I'm a hematologist, adult hematologist, and coagulationist. I'm at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I deal mostly with thrombosis, anticoagulation, thrombophilia, but to some degree also with other bleeding disorders and benign hematology. Thanks very much for having me here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, so we'll dive right in. Our objectives today are I'm going to briefly recap what we talked about in podcast 1 and 2. We're going to talk about some important considerations for when you're managing or treating VTE with anticoagulation in the long term. Things like drug-drug interactions, over-the-counter medications and supplements, pain medications, heavy menstrual bleeding. We're going to talk about perioperative interruption of anticoagulants as well, contraceptive management. So trying to touch on as many themes as possible that come up in that long-term management piece. And then we're also going to talk about the potential long-term sequelae of DVT and PE, things like post-thrombotic syndrome, post-PE syndrome, and how we manage those and diagnose them. Very briefly, I do encourage you to tune in and take a listen to podcast 1 and 2 if you haven't already. In podcast 1, we talk about the acute management of VTE. And then in podcast 2, we talk about the duration of anticoagulation. Stefan introduced us to this concept of the recurrence triangle, an idea that helps us distinguish who needs to be treated for the long term versus who is treated for a limited duration. Kind of the general theme that I want you to remember is that in patients that have a clear major transient risk factor, there is a clear reason why their clot developed, like being in the hospital and having surgery. Those things are reversible. That patient can come off anticoagulation after 3 months. And people without risk factors or with more minor risk factors, that decision can be more nuanced, but usually we're talking about long-term anticoagulation. So those are the patients that we're going to be talking about today. And again, there's lots of rich discussion around this topic in podcast 1 and 2, so I encourage you to tune in.
And Jory, if I could just reinforce, I think that is one of the key first questions people should ask when they see a patient on anticoagulant for DVT-PE. Do they really still need to be on it and not just continue doing what has been done in the last year or 2 or 5 years?
I think that's a really important point. We're jumping to long-term, assuming that that consideration is made in the encounter. And so as a primary care provider, you're going to see a lot of people already on anticoagulation, making sure that's absolutely necessary. Great point. So let's dive into a case. A patient that's probably walked into many primary care offices, a 62-year-old male that has what we call an unprovoked proximal leg DVT. So this patient had no major transient risk factors, no clear explanation for what caused his blood clot. And so based on podcast 2 and what we learned there, we would say that this patient required long-term anticoagulation. But at this point, we want to discuss strategies to ensure the safety and efficacy of long-term anticoagulation in this patient. How can we make sure that he's optimally cared for? So Bill, I want to come to you first as a pharmacist. You know, you have a lot of options for anticoagulation at this point, some newer and some older. Can you kind of touch on what our options are for anticoagulation in an outpatient?
Yeah, so the DOAC class, you know, comprises of apixaban, rivaroxaban, edoxaban, and dabigatran. They're factor 10A inhibitors with the exception of dabigatran, which is a direct thrombin inhibitor, but they're all tied in this DOAC class. So they're all potential options. Warfarin, of course, is our old school agent that we've used forever. It potentially could have a place maybe in patients with end-stage renal disease or other factors, but DOACs typically are preferred in most cases. And then the low molecular weight heparins still play a role in cancer patients and in pregnancy. And then you have fondaparinux. Typically, we use for heparin-induced thrombocytopenia patients, those patients that can't take low molecular weight heparins or heparin for the most part. And then, of course, there's aspirin, and that's usually not recommended in the guidelines, but it's as a last resort. If patients are non-compliant, could be maybe an option down the road for those patients.
And so when you're making these initial decisions on anticoagulation selection, so you have a patient with a history of VTE, they need to be on long-term anticoagulation. What are the things that a provider should be thinking about or considering to help make the decision between which agent to use?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, you know, DOACs are probably, you know, the safest of, you know, compared to warfarin and most of the clinical trials that are out there. But again, the dose specifically and making sure that we're, you know, most of the DOACs have an AFib indication as well. And they have renal adjustments for AFib, which is different for VTE. So that's something to definitely consider. But even edoxaban, for instance, if you have like, you know, really good creatinine clearance over 95 in the AFib trials, they don't recommend using edoxaban. So, and most of the VTEs don't have good data on it. So it's probably not a good choice to use in those particular patients.
You mentioned edoxaban, but edoxaban in the US has not been marketed well, if at all. I've only used it twice in the last several years, even though the clinical trials look good and it's been FDA approved for DVTP treatment. Does that look different in Florida? Are people using edoxaban?
We're not really seeing edoxaban at all. Yeah. It's pretty much, you know, pixaban.
I didn't think so either. So we shouldn't really put it out there. That's the point I'm making, that people are wondering, oh, well, should I be using this or not? People can use it, but it's not much marketed. It's really mostly the apixaban and rivaroxaban, and then dabigatran as the one that's been around the longest, but with some side effects with GI upset and renal clearance that's so significant that it's being used less and less and less. Thanks for letting me put that in there.
Yes, no, that's a good point. Yeah, I haven't really used edoxaban at all too much, but I just wanted to throw that out there. And then liver function, you know, severe hepatic impairment, DOACs typically are not recommended. And then, of course, we have the drug-drug interactions with the strong CYP3A4 and PGP inducers, not typically rated or recommended with DOAC therapy. And then the financial burden on these patients as well. And can they afford long-term therapy and the availability of copay cards with those patients? And of course, you got the compliance. You know, warfarin requires monitoring. That's always an issue with warfarin, where the DOACs definitely have an advantage, more specifically. And then patients with elevated BMI, overweight patients, there's data with apixaban and rivaroxaban. The guidelines kind of recommend those two agents. So that's, you know, and warfarin, of course. And then age is also a factor. Most of the patients in the studies do better on the DOACs compared to Coumadin in elderly patients, and would be a better recommendation. And then, of course, history of GI bleed as well. Apixaban has good data with regards to use in patients that have high risk for GI bleeding. And then, you know, tube feedings, dabigatran, you can't open the capsules or chew, so that's also an issue with that particular agent.
If I may, just because it came up, your liver, adequate liver function, and yeah, it's true that the DOACs are cleared partially in the liver, and in severe liver dysfunction, they're not a great choice. But in severe liver disease, none of the anticoagulants are good choices. In liver cirrhosis, the baseline INR is elevated. Patients often have thrombocytopenia from big spleen and thrombocytopenia, bleeding, varices, and lumecoid heparin is also difficult to manage because those patients are at high risk for bleeding. So none of these anticoagulants are really easy options in severe liver disease.
That's a great point. You know, I think, Bill, you provided a rapid fire of so many nuances and really highlight how difficult this is. I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, we thought with the DOACs, everything would be more straightforward. We just put people on those anticoagulants and that's what everybody does. But there's a lot more nuance to it. There's a lot of considerations based on other comorbidities, other medications. And we are going to dive into kind of specific issues that you mentioned. You provided a nice overview, but we're going to kind of go into those in more detail, some in this podcast and some in future podcasts as well. You know, one of the things that you mentioned is renal function. We're going to talk specifically about that in the future, because this is a challenging area of what to do with certain direct oral anticoagulants in the world of VTE. Can you kind of give us a quick rundown? Is there one direct oral anticoagulant that you tend to favor in someone with renal dysfunction, or is there any sort of specific threshold where you don't feel comfortable using them?
Yeah, I mean, apixaban probably has the most data from this standpoint for renal. Yeah, there's a lot of data in AFib, actually, not so much in VTE. But basically, you know, it could be, you could go down to about 15 creatinine clearance, but you would want to go below that typically with the data that we have so far.
Even though it sounds a little complex when we say all these things to take consider, but down underneath the line, it's still pretty straightforward. And the ACCP guidelines and other guidelines also clearly state the go-to anticoagulant in the majority of patients with DVTPE are the DOACs. And the ones that we marketed or that we use mostly and most widely apixaban and rivaroxaban. And with a renal function that you just mentioned, it's true, apixaban is the least cleared in the kidneys, so it's the go-to drug in end-stage renal disease, including hemodialysis, and in the patient with some impairment. Yes, there are nuances with all the other liver disease and such, and we'll get to that. But in the majority of patients, the decision-making is not that difficult, apixaban or rivaroxaban mostly. And often the driver is, and we'll talk about that, is the cost. What is most affordable for the patient? Where's the copay the least?
That's a great point, Stefan. And I guess it would be helpful, and Bill mentioned this, some of the differences in selecting doses for those two most common agents that we use for apixaban and rivaroxaban. Can you highlight briefly the dosing for venous thromboembolism of apixaban and rivaroxaban, the difference of that initial management and long-term management, how doses might differ and how that might differ from patients that are on the same medications for atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, so, you know, typically for initial management, rivaroxaban, you don't have to, you know, use parenteral lead-in with those particular agents with apixaban or rivaroxaban. So you can start right when you diagnose the VTE. You start at 15 milligrams BID for 21 days. And then, of course, after that, you stepped into 20 milligrams daily. And then apixaban, you know, 10 milligrams BID for 7 days, and then transition to the apixaban 5 milligrams BID. With the other agents, you got to have the lead in, you know, with parenteral anticoagulation for a minimum of 5 days before you can switch. Doxaban would then go to 60 milligrams daily, and the dabigatran 150 BID. And then, of course, warfarin, you would base it off ion interval of 2 to 3 for the most part.
And an interesting concept here to observe is people thought in the clinical trial design that maybe for the first few days or weeks, you need a higher dose because the patient is very clottable. But there is no agreement. Is there really an acute time where people need a higher dose? And if there is it a week long, like the apixaban trials were designed, or is it 3 weeks long, like the rivaroxaban trial was designed? Or the dabigatran trial did not use any higher dose, they just kept the same dose. It's a lack of scientific knowledge. Do you really need a higher dose? But by clinical trials and the FDA approval, this is how the drugs should be used.
That's a great point. And different from AFib, right? That we don't have that lead-in dose. So that is a difference that sometimes people don't catch.
And we see that all of us, right? People get started on, for example, the higher dose with apixaban or rivaroxaban. The patient, for some reason, doesn't get taken on to the lower dose and continue, and you see them at 3 months and they're still on the rivaroxaban 15 BID or the apixaban, the 10 BID. That's something really to keep in mind if we see a patient with an acute DVT, that there's clear indication to lower the dose to the maintenance dose.
Absolutely. I think the alternative in that people who meet criteria for dose reduction atrial fibrillation based on renal function, based on age, that same criteria does not apply to the VTE space. So being very deliberate about understanding the indication that you're prescribing the anticoagulant for to ensure that you're following the appropriate dose.
Jerry, should we also talk about the dose reduction that is possible at 6 months? I mean, we have patients with DVT-PE, if they're on rivaroxaban or apixaban. For each of them, there has been a trial that at 6 months, there's a further dose reduction to a prophylactic dosing. For rivaroxaban, it would mean the 10 milligram once daily. And for apixaban, it would be the 2.5 milligram twice daily. And that would be then long-term. And those two studies are referred to as Amplify Extension and Einstein Choice Trial, New England Journal quality publications, showed that the lower dose is as effective as the full dose. And from a safety point of view, is similar. Maybe there's a tad bit of an advantage. So certainly at 6 months, it could be considered to lower patients. Do I do that in everybody? No. There are different practices. I lower the dose if I'm not quite sure, does this patient really need to be on long-term blood thinners or not? Which by this recurrence triangle that we discussed earlier in the last podcast, is that people with this intermediate risk of recurrence. And I lower the dose. So I use the full dose in patients with clearly unprovoked clot, the more heavy ones, the ones who tolerate it well, and the younger ones. But I lower the dose in the people where I have equipoise and don't quite know, do they really need to be in long-term blood thinners? The elderly, the fragile, and the low body weight patients.
It's nice to know about that data and have that flexibility. But I think it's important that you highlight, it's not something you have to do. And if you talk to a lot of hematologists, there's a lot of variation in practice there. It's not that everybody gets reduced. It's with consideration of how severe their VTE was, what their risk of bleeding was, things along those lines. And so we've mentioned cost. We actually mentioned this in a previous podcast too, but I think it's important to highlight again that particularly when we're talking about apixaban and rivaroxaban being our, tends to be first line options, that we have to make sure that it's affordable for our patients. So Bill, do you have kind of some tips and tricks on if a primary care doctor has a patient on this medication, how can they help make sure that their patient can access it if they need it?
Yeah, knowing the type of insurance they have, and each insurance has tier levels, of course, and they may have one preferred versus the agent or versus other agents. And so that's something to look at. And the copay cards, making sure that they have the copay cards. So that way, when they get the script and they go to the pharmacy, it'll be reduced potentially based on what their coverage is and their gap, basically. So you know, typically, it can be between $10 to $40 typically for a script. Which is very reasonable. And of course, there is patient assistant programs for apixaban or rivaroxaban to help those patients long-term if they don't have insurance. And they also have the free 30-day coupon that basically, yeah, they'll pay nothing for the first 30 days. So making sure that they have those resources, I think, is really important for compliance, because that's something we really want to make sure that they're compliant on these medications and they don't stop abruptly.
If I may add to that, so when we see these patients at 3 months or 6 months and we see how did you tolerate it, bleeding issues, et cetera, one of the questions I always ask, number one, what is your copay? But secondly, also, what is your rivaroxaban hate factor or your apixaban hate factor on a scale from 0 to 10? And then you need to take it. 0 means it's just a pill, no big deal. 10, I hate it incredibly. And I ask specifically about the cost and the copay, how that influences them. And then patients often spill out that their copay is so high. That's a pain for every patient and for the physicians as well. Unfortunately, we have a pharmacist in our clinic who is very well versed in finding out what the copay is and which why it is so high, et cetera, et cetera. But it's so time consuming to talk to patients about copay and cost. It's not a good development, but it's something that's really key to also then be sure that the patient stays on the drug. Sometimes if the copay is high on one drug, I use the other one. Or if the copay card has run out for one, for apixaban, I switch them to rivaroxaban and they have a copay card as well. So one can play around there, but it's a little cumbersome, I must say.
Perhaps I'll put you both on the spot a little bit. If you have a patient that has if you got to pick what anticoagulant to start in a patient, do you have a preference? Is there one that you go to more often than the other, or it's really based on kind of insurance and access? Any thoughts, Bill? Do you have a favorite?
I mean, looking at the studies, I think apixaban, probably has good efficacy and maybe the safest, in my opinion. You know, just kind of look, there's no head-to-head trials, but there's, you know, some meta-analysis that were done that looked at rivaroxaban and apixaban, but that's my preference, at least, as long as the insurance covers it and whatnot. And I think the BID dosing reflects the half-life of the drug really well as well.
And Stefan, what about you?
So first of all, I'm going to say I have no conflict of interest. I'm not being supported in any way by either one of these companies.
Yes, me either.
And then I'm going to say these drugs have never been compared head-to-head in a prospective study. So we don't really know whether one is better or worse than the other. One prospective trial was attempted with federal funding from PCORI, I think, where they were randomizing patients with DVT-PE to get one of three arms, apixaban, rivaroxaban, or warfarin. And this study didn't fly because nobody wanted to randomize to warfarin. I didn't participate in the trial because I didn't want to use warfarin or offer patients or have a chance that they were randomized to warfarin. So the retrospective data in general suggests that maybe apixaban is a tad bit safer from a major bleeding point of view, and maybe particularly from a vaginal menstrual bleed point of view. And yes, so apixaban is a good choice and maybe my preferred choice, but I wouldn't say that strongly. For me, they're pretty much interchangeable. Some patients really like the once daily and struggle with the twice daily. And then sometimes, and not infrequently, I pick the drug, whatever is least expensive. I tell the patient we could use this or that, inquire what the copay would be for either one, and that's the one that I would support. And I have a number of patients on rivaroxaban that I don't switch over to apixaban, even though I think maybe it's a tad bit safer, because they've done fine on rivaroxaban and they like the once daily. Yes, so that's my approach. Dabigatran, I barely ever use as a first go-to drug. I have a few patients on it. Edoxaban, I've used only a couple of times. I'm using a couple of times because of cost issues for the patient.
I think that's helpful. I'll highlight as well that rivaroxaban needs to be taken with food. I find that is often an issue for people if they are more comfortable taking their medications at bedtime or they like to take it in the morning and they don't eat breakfast. It's something that I think is underappreciated and can really affect the absorption of rivaroxaban. So it's important to keep in mind.
I do want to also mention there, yes, in the first 3 months of an acute DVTP treatment, I want the patient to be on full dose and take it with food and have it well absorbed. But after three or particularly after 6 months, we know that the 10 milligram dose is as effective as a 20. So if patients are on 20 milligram, I said, look, you can loosen up. It doesn't really matter whether it's absorbed 20% less. That's still 16 milligrams per day that you're getting. I'm fine with that because it's still even more than the 10 milligram with a dose reduction. So I would not overvalue the importance of the food issues. And otherwise, which is self-understood for most people, these drugs are not interfered with by food. Patients ask that sometimes still from the warfarin times, and that is irrelevant, the vitamin K issues.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, and Stefan, you bring up warfarin, and if you could maybe say a brief bit, I know that, you know, warfarin was a large part of your practice in the past, and you know, certainly it still has its uses in specific populations. If you can maybe speak to a couple of pearls about using warfarin, ways to make it a little easier for patients.
Why do you say it's been a big part of my practice? Because I'm so old?
I didn't say that.
I mean, many of us grew up with dealing with warfarin, and it was painful for the patients. And that's actually where this warfarin hate factor from 0 to 10 came from, that I've been using for many years and then translated to rivaroxaban and apixaban. Take together the need for monitoring, for dietary interactions, the risk for bleeding, the cost, going to the physicians, how much do you hate it? And then they would say it's 15 or 16, which means they really hate it. And if it's then just the diet and the monitoring, then you can switch to a DOAC. But if it's just the risk for bleeding and the concern and having to take a medication, a DOAC is not a solution because it's still a blood thinner. But you also point out INR home monitoring. So I'm German and I used to practice in Germany, and INR home monitoring in Germany was very popular and I like it. The patient can test themselves. In Germany, they get taught how to adjust their warfarin. They often do it better than providers. Here in the US, it has not really taken off. Well, it never really took off. There's some pockets where INR home monitoring is used. If I was on warfarin for some reason, I would want an INR home monitor. But there's been a lot of movement with legal issues, but particularly reimbursement, that the pharmacist provider still gets called with the results, can not bill for it or not appropriately bill for it. If the patient needs to be on warfarin, I would like to find a place for them that does INR home monitoring or that supports it. But those places are very few.
Excellent teaching points from a seasoned hematologist, Stefan.
Thank you.
So, Bill, you brought this up previously, but I think it's worth mentioning a little bit more, drug-drug interactions. So as a hematologist, I hear CYP inhibitors and PGP, and I get a little bit glossy-eyed. So I wonder if for the clinician you can highlight for us, you know, what are those things that we need to be thinking about when we're looking at a patient's medication list to ensure that we're avoiding really relevant medication interactions, particularly with the direct oral anticoagulants?
Yeah, the inducers are the big ones. You know, the anti-seizure medications, carbamazepine, you know, phenytoin are big ones. You know, the herbal, you know, St. John's wort, not too common, but rifampin, an antibiotic that's added a lot of times to therapy, and endocarditis. But those are the main ones, and that's for all the DOACs, actually, the inducers, and there's also combined PGP inducers as well, so which affects the absorption of the of these drugs. So those are the main ones to really look at. And it kind of gets a little cloudy when you start jumping into some of the other ones, that when you start getting to moderate, becomes a little more difficult. But one thing to think about that I want to just mention is rivaroxaban, 50% of the metabolism goes through the hepatic CYP pathway, whereas apixaban, only 25%. And so that's kind of why you see a lot of times the dose reduction on rivaroxaban for these inhibitors. It says avoid use potentially for rivaroxaban because of that. And the apixaban has a dose reduction on those patients that have the strong PGP inhibitor combination. So that's something to think about with azole and antifungals. For the most part, and then you have dabigatran and edoxaban don't really have too much of a CYP pathway. They're pretty much on the PGP pathway. And of course, dabigatran has, warnings for creatinine clearance, not to recommend in situations. And the edoxaban has a dose reduction, and they specifically in their package insert verapamil, erythromycin, clarithromycin, Maltac is used, dronidrolone, which is common for antiarrhythmics, erythromycin, you don't really see too much. And then, of course, the azole, itraconazole, and ketoconazole, you have to dose reduce on that particular situation. So it does become complicated.
Yes, well, it does.
It's complicated, even though in a way it's also simple. I mean, we have the internet-based drug interaction abilities, and that's what I find myself doing at times, that I just check on, is there a drug interaction and how severe is it? I think one of the important teaching points is there's so many new oncological drugs in use that particularly in oncology, my teaching to the oncologist is make sure that you put whatever oncological drug you're using into the drug interaction database to see how it interacts with the drugs that your patient is taking.
Yeah, I think I kind of think of it, certain antimicrobials, anti-seizures, anti-cancer, those are the classes of medications where I try to remind myself, like you said, Stefan, using an interaction checker in order to guide us, or calling a fantastic pharmacist like Bill to guide us.
Yeah, and COVID now is, Paxlovid is common and has ritonavir in there. So that's is something to consider as well. But I think we'll talk about that maybe at the next session. So
that's a great point. So let's also mention, we talked about, I think you mentioned St. John's Wort, but Bill, could you go through, are there supplements that you're concerned about? These are things that often don't show up on a patient's medication list, but are there things that you're asking about or double checking for patients on DOAC?
Yeah, these are the pharmacodynamic issues. A lot of them have antiplatelet properties and can have an additive effect to patients. So I think we need to counsel and find out what they're taking. Some are definitely more an issue than others. Turmeric seems to be pretty popular now. Everyone's taking that. And it can have some moderate platelet aggregation reduction. So that's possible as well. So, I think it's something, St. John's Wort definitely should be avoided at all costs, but I think counseling patients on moderation and not overdoing it, I think is a key component here. And making sure, if you had aspirin with a combination of this, then I think you're definitely increasing your risk. Definitely should counsel patients on that.
And you bring up aspirin. I think that's really important to talk about because it is in the unprescribed realm, but has significant blood thinning activities. Let's say, trying to bring this back to the patient that we talked about in the beginning, that patient, 65 years old, has an unprovoked VTE. And let's say that patient has been on aspirin, we'll say for primary prevention of coronary artery disease. I know that's a huge topic of whether we're using aspirin for that purpose, but we're certainly seeing it a lot now. So I wonder, what do you think about in that patient? Do you keep them on the aspirin? Do you stop the aspirin if you're continuing an anticoagulant? And maybe, Stefan, could you kind of take us through your thought process on that?
I can, but I'm going to turn it around, Jory. You have published on this, and it's a really nice paper. When people have an arterial indication to be on an antiplatelet agent and have a venous indication to be on an anticoagulant, what do you do? Do you just add aspirin and anticoagulant? And then what about if they have a stent? Do you add aspirin and clopidogrel and they have a VTE, then you have triple therapy? These really complex patients need a lot of thought. This one that you mentioned just now, if patient is on aspirin for primary coronary artery disease prevention and now needs anticoagulant for VTE, you stop aspirin. That's the right thing to do. There's no role for continuing aspirin. More commonly, even before that, the question should come up, should this patient have been on aspirin in the first place? But that's not we see the patient when they have a VTE and they should not be on aspirin. Beyond that, it becomes a little more complex. When did they have their heart attack or their stent placed? And where in the course of the double therapy are they? We'll discuss that somewhere down the line.
Yeah,
I do absolutely. Want to say, though, Jory, because it didn't fully become clear, I think, a little earlier, aspirin does not have much of a role in the prevention of venous thromboembolism. So if a patient had a DVT-PE and there is an indication to be on long-term blood thinners and they don't want to take it, I would, and they stop at 3 or 6 months, I tell them, and they ask me, can I not just take aspirin? I tell them, it has minimal effect, so don't count on it. The risk of recurrence is still pretty significant. Yes, if rather than nothing, it's appropriate to take aspirin, but I really would like you to see on blood thinners. And I mentioned the low dose of apixaban and rivaroxaban, at least we know that for the rivaroxaban, are as safe or unsafe as aspirin. Aspirin is not a completely safe drug. So with aspirin, you get the negative side effects of bleeding risk, but not the positive of preventing VTE.
Those are really helpful points. And I think from a primary care perspective, I think what I think is most helpful is asking that question of, is the aspirin needed? Like you said, particularly if you've got a patient who's now on anticoagulation, and is it that you can question the cardiologist who may be more familiar with the guidance in the cardiology space of, you know, when a patient is on anticoagulation, do you continue the aspirin based on when their stent was, or the patient with peripheral artery disease, the patient with a history of stroke? You know, we've talked about multiple things we're looking for in the med list. Adding aspirin to your mental checklist to say, I have a patient on anticoagulation, they're on aspirin. Who do I need to talk to see if that's necessary or if we can potentially de-escalate?
Jory, I would like to, if you allow me, to say one word to the previous topic of the fish oil and vitamin E and the non-prescription supplements that people take. My comment to the patient is a little stronger than what Bill's comment is. When Bill said take it in moderation or consider taking it in moderation, my comment is many of them have antiplatelet effects. We don't know whether it really increases the risk of bleeding if you take it together with a DOAC, but it may. And my preference is that you don't take them when you're on the anticoagulant. So I'm much stronger about that. But it's also my background that I don't believe in too many supplements that they really have beneficial effect. In that case, I am indeed, as you said earlier, more seasoned.
So I think along this line, again, we're talking about other medications that we're thinking about. So it's often that so let's say our 65-year-old patient with an unprovoked DVT comes in, and he's still having a lot of leg pain associated with his blood clot. So the question we often get is, well, what pain medications are safe for that patient to take? Bill, could you maybe speak to that a little bit? Is what, you know, over-the-counter medications, prescribed medications, you know, what are our options for pain management in people on anticoagulation?
Yeah, Tylenol doesn't really have any interactions at all. Slight interaction with Coumadin, but we're not dealing with that usually. But yeah, 3,000 milligrams a day is typically a safe bet if you're going to be on it chronically. Of course, we don't want to get close to 4,000 milligrams because it's linked to liver toxicity. But definitely, you know, acetaminophen definitely is a good option, I think, for pain. Non-steroidals, you want to avoid, you know, increased bleed risk. You have the COX-2 inhibitors, the Celebrex is definitely a potential option as well. You don't have the same issues with the typical standard COX-1 and COX-2 inhibitors. With the standard non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So definitely could be an option as well. And of course, opioids, you know, don't have any interactions. But again, you know, there's a fall risk with these patients as well. And that's something to think about. I didn't really discuss earlier, but that's something, you know, I work in the hospital and I see patients admitted for falls with intracranial hemorrhage. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind too, to make sure we're not overdosing on opioids that could potentially cause increased fall risk.
Let me make, please, an additional comment. I agree that the non-steroidals obviously increase risk for bleeding, but so often patients are being told you absolutely cannot take ibuprofen or a non-steroidal, and then they suffer through their rheumatoid arthritis or their whatever pain they have, the chronic lower back pain, and Tylenol doesn't touch it. I think about Celebrex use, and this comes from the hemophilia population, and I feel okay using Celebrex. However, I also tell the patient, look, yes, the non-steroidals do increase the risk for bleeding in the overall studies, but the overall risk for bleeding is not huge. keep in mind that we use anticoagulants plus aspirin in a number of people with history of stents and what have you. And yes, we do increase risk of bleeding, but we also need to keep in mind the quality of life of the patients. So I tell them non-steroidals, ibuprofen is not unreasonable if you have significant pain, realizing that there's some increased risk of bleeding, but you may very well do fine. Take as little as you can. I'm not this black and white, you should not take non-steroidals. I don't think we do a good service to patients by saying that so strongly.
That's helpful. I think it's often helpful to think about too, you know, there's no direct data for this, but in the antiplatelet anticoagulation world, there's data to suggest using PPIs can be helpful to decrease that risk of GI bleeding. So if you have that patient that really needs celecoxib or really needs a concurrent medication, is there a benefit from adding a PPI? I can't say for sure. It makes me feel a little better. So sometimes I do. But acknowledging the nuance there, I think, is really important. So let's say this same patient now, he is, let's say, 8 months after his VTE. He's on his anticoagulation. He's taking his apixaban, 5 milligrams twice daily. He's doing great, but he's having issues with gallstones, and so he needs to have a cholecystectomy. This is, I'm sure, a question that our primary care providers get a lot. And Bill, I'm sure something you deal with even on the inpatient side. So can you talk a little bit about how we hold anticoagulation for procedures? Maybe talking more about the direct oral anticoagulants, but mentioning to warfarin how that literature has changed recently.
Yeah, so with the PAUSE trial, that was a pretty big trial in JAMA. Actually, it was published in 2019. That kind of changed practice a little bit. Before, we would be bridging patients, and it was very complex in that scenario. But yeah, the PAUSE trial, you know, basically showed it was safe to where we could hold these medications before the procedure, depending on if it's high risk or low risk, based on the half-life of the drug, three times the T-half. Basically, you'd hold 1 day prior. And then if it's a severe surgery or high-risk surgery, you would go out 2 days based on the half-life of the drug. And then, of course, for dabigatran, the studies with the creatinine clearance less than 50, we would go out further 2 days for low risk and then out 4 days for high risk. And so that seemed to work really well in the study and was really good that we had some sort of guidance in this, because it definitely was an issue in the past when these agents first came out. So definitely the PAUSE trial was a significant trial for surgery.
An important point there also is when we see a patient who had a recent DVT-PE, we typically recommend for the first 3 months, we should not do an elective procedure. It should be uninterrupted anticoagulation. And once they're over this acute phase, then it's reasonable to have them off for a day or two or three. That risk of recurrence during those few days is not particularly high. But for example, if a patient presents with DVT-PE, there's a question, they haven't had their screening colonoscopy, we hold off. We don't do that in the first 3 months. And even more so, sometimes there's a more important in a different way. Sometimes there's a more urgent need for a surgery, and the patient had a very recent DVT-PE, then I tell the provider, if you can avoid operating in the first 4 weeks, then we're really beyond the very acute phase. If they cannot wait for 3 months, at least wait for 4 weeks.
I think that's really important. And if I might summarize for docs, I think I still get a lot of questions about bridging them. And so the take home that Bill said is there's no bridging in the DOAC world anymore. We basically, based on our assessment of bleeding risk, we hold it. So let's say the procedure is Wednesday. Hold 1 to 2 days before. So don't take it Monday, don't take it Tuesday, don't take it Wednesday. And then we usually restart either the day after on Thursday or the day after that on Friday. Some wiggle room with that based on the assessment of risk, but that there's no benefit to putting the patient on Lovenox at all in that period of time.
And the reason is that the half-life of the DOACs is not that different to Lomecort heparin. Lomecort heparin is somewhat of a shorter half-life, but based on the dosing, Lomecort heparin, enoxaparin once or twice daily, dalteparin often once daily, it doesn't make any intuitive sense to bridge one short half-life drug with another short half-life drug.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about the interruption with a major risk bleeding surgeries. You stop for 2 days before and nothing on the day of surgery, and I fully agree with that. And the PAUSE trial is a nice algorithm, which I have in our Epic system as a table, and I import that into the patient's information material. And then when to restart after the surgery, well, with a high-risk bleeding procedure, you don't want to start immediately, but you also don't want the patient on nothing because they were on blood thinners for a DVT-PE history and now they have major surgery. So then I make the point that you want to start probably prophylactic anticoagulation at least, and then when it is safe from the surgeon's point of view to progress, then you can put them back on full-dose anticoagulation. But we shouldn't forget about the prophylactic dosing because they had a DVT-PE and are now at high risk because of the major surgery.
And Stefan, I think we're going to talk about this in detail in the future, but I think another question when we're talking about holding blood thinners people may get in their practice is, what about those people that are active in sports that might increase their bleeding risk? So our patient likes to go mountain biking or he likes to play soccer. Can you give us a brief overview of how you think about that or how you approach that?
So we said the half-life of the DOACs is around 10 hours. There's a relatively widespread, but for mountain biking, for example, on the weekend, and I ask, how significant is the mountain biking that you do? How often have you fallen in the last year? How likely is it that you will have some trauma? And that helps us, do they really need to come off anticoagulation at all or not? But it's easy enough to skip if they're on BID, apixaban, skip the morning dose, or if they're on QH evening dosing of rivaroxaban, don't take the drug on the evening before. Again, not in the first 3 months when they need uninterrupted, but after 3 months. And then the risk for another clot, if you skip one or two doses, is not significant. But the risk for bleeding depends really on what sport they do, how often during the week do they do it, and how often have they actually had trauma. Make sure they do the usual with biking and skiing, to wear a helmet. I feel like, Jerry, I would love to talk about this a little more, but I don't want to duplicate what we do in podcast number 4, because one of my interests, as you know, is high-level athletes on blood thinners, and we use an intermittent anticoagulation strategy. Maybe we'll talk a little more about that at that point.
I think that's a great idea. Let's save it, because I do want us to save some time to talk about these long-term complications of venous thromboembolism. So what we often find, or occasionally will find, is that same patient that we've been talking about, our gentleman that had an unprovoked DVT, is 3-6 months out, and he's still having swelling in that right lower extremity where his clot was. And so I think the question to the primary care doctor is, well, what do you do next in that situation? And maybe, Stefan, can you talk a little bit about the long-term complications of DVT, what to look for and how to manage that?
Sure. And everybody's familiar with the symptoms of DVT, mostly the swelling and pain and leg heaviness and not being able to do what they want to do. This is not uncommon after DVT-PE, and it may stabilize at a certain level. When I see the patient at 3 months or 6 months, I typically ask about those symptoms, measure the leg circumference at the mid-calf, and then make an assessment, has it stabilized or is it still improving? If it's pretty significant and it's not improving further and it's quality of life impacting, then I think, what can we do to help this patient? Number one, we can recommend compression stockings. And the compression stockings are not mandatory for everybody. That's really up to the patient. Some people find they're beneficial, they should then wear it and they judge themselves. Some people feel they're uncomfortable. We have learned that the stockings don't prevent the postthrombotic syndrome. They just treat the symptoms. So as long as the patient wears them, they may have benefit. If they don't then stop them, the postthrombotic syndrome is there. So you don't prevent the long-term complications. So it's up to the patient whether they wear them or not. So stockings are one option. Then I tend to get a follow-up Doppler to look at residual scar tissue. And then particularly I think about, and this is maybe going a little too far, or maybe not for a primary care physician, if they have significant symptoms, I wonder if there's some pelvic vein scar tissue that's obstructing outflow. And if there is, then potentially vascular interventional or vascular surgery intervention with angioplasty and stenting might be beneficial. So I then think about a CT venogram. Some people might do an MR venogram, but CT venogram is more widely available, more experience with it. And that may well show you that there is some narrowing in the pelvic veins, and then one can send them to vascular surgery or vascular radiology for consideration of angioplasty. However, we don't really know how beneficial these interventions are. In many patients, they don't help. There is currently a trial ongoing called the C-TRACT trial that takes patients with chronic postsymptomatic syndrome and randomizes them into an intervention versus no intervention, because we just don't really know who benefits and is it overall beneficial. Because you could argue the radiologist, they see a narrowing, they would like to put a stent is placed, but a stent is a foreign body, it may reocclude endothelial cell proliferation. Actually, things may get worse by doing an intervention. So that's a little bit of an unanswered question. But, and we participate in the C-TRACT trial, so I do refer the patients for consideration and enrollment. But I think it's worthwhile to do a CT venogram, assess the status, and if it's quality of life limiting, then to send the patient to radiology and ask them for an angioplasty with potential stenting. And then lastly, and I don't use that very often or prescribe it often, maybe once or twice a year, a lymphedema pump that can be worn by the patient at home 30 or 60 minutes in the evening. At least they get symptom relief. Next morning they feel better, but once they're up on their feet, it swells up again. But then in the evening, they can put the pump back on. And then less commonly, I get involved in the pain management issues. More likely, I refer them to the pain clinic for consideration. How do we manage this chronic leg pain? And then disability assistance may be appropriate because they cannot do what they used to be able to do.
That's a really helpful overview. One thing I want to highlight that I think I come across in my practice is sometimes if there is residual swelling in the leg and say a provider orders an ultrasound and we are 6-12 months out and they do an ultrasound and the ultrasound says there's clot there. Oftentimes people see that, patients see that. If they're off anticoagulation, that makes them uncomfortable, that there's clot, you know, something's wrong. Stephen, can you maybe translate that a little bit? Is that concerning to you? Is that clot? Does a patient need to be anticoagulated based on that finding?
That's good that you bring this up, Jory. First of all, I would discourage us from calling it chronic clot because patients often think it's clot, it can still break off, and physicians some think, oh, it's clot, it needs to be anticoagulated, but it's scar tissue. It does not break off. So the question you are scientifically asking is, does residual scar tissue or residual clot, does scar tissue predict a higher risk of recurrence if the patient comes off blood thinners? Should it influence our management? And there are mixed scientific results on that with the clinical studies. I barely ever use the residual scar tissue or clot to determine how long to treat. We know that 50% of people after DVT will have leftover scar tissue at 3 or 6 months. That's really common. And no, I would still stop anticoagulation if this was a hip replacement associated DVT. At 3 months, there is scar tissue. It would not influence my management. However, whenever we stop anticoagulation, it's appropriate and is recommended by the International Society on Thrombosehemostasis, ISTH. And I agree with that. I do that too. Whenever we stop anticoagulation, we should get a baseline Doppler ultrasound. And why? Not to look, is there scar tissue or not? And should I restart the anticoagulant or should I maybe not have stopped? But we do that so that if problems come up in a year or two, new leg symptoms, and there's a DVT then diagnosed, we know this is new since the patient came off blood thinners, and that's where the baseline study comes in. I don't do that for pulmonary embolism. I don't do a routine follow-up CT scan for two reasons. Number one, the lung has a huge potential to dissolve blood clots. So after a PE, very frequently the lung returns to normal. And the CT is radiation exposure, so I like to avoid that. But people after PE, particularly after the major PE that was not treated with thrombectomy, for example, or that was only partially, the clot was removed, people may develop the chronic PE syndrome, and we'll get to that a little more. But the scan to do after a PE 3-6 months later is not a CT scan to assess it's a lung damage, but it's a VQ scan. The CT scan is not sensitive to pick up chronic perfusion defects. The VQ scan picks it up. And if there are multiple perfusion defects and there is concern for lung damage and pulmonary hypertension with right heart strain, the VQ scan shows the perfusion defects, then a referral to the pulmonary hypertension clinic or in general for the to the pulmonologist is appropriate for the consideration of a right heart cath, a pulmonary artery pressure measurement, and then the decision should this patient be sent for a pulmonary and arterectomy.
So that you've dived into a really important topic, Stefan. If we can maybe take a step back. So now, you know, we're venturing into long-term management of PE. And so similarly, if our patient comes in 6 months down the line and they're still having shortness of breath, you know, they're still feeling fatigued. You brought up this idea of post-PE syndrome and the imaging you would do for that. Can you kind of take us briefly back and then talk about, you know, again, you already talked about the imaging, VQ scan is helpful, but just an overview of what post-PE syndrome is and what a primary care doctor should be looking for in order to catch that.
Important point. So after PE, the symptoms often improve in the next few weeks and months, and even at 3 months, it can still improve. But when the patient says symptoms have leveled off, that's when you start to think, is there chronic lung damage done? I like the term post-PE syndrome because it really, sometimes patients have this unspecific chest pain, chest discomfort. They may not be able to do what they used to be able to do, more short of breath. That's the post-PE syndrome, symptoms that are sometimes unspecific. It's only the more severe damage that gets done to the lung where that leads to pulmonary hypertension that then is called CTEPH or chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. So what I do in clinic when I see them at 3 months and what physicians in who see these patients, the stepwise approach is a good history. Are you back to your normal self, fatigue, et cetera, et cetera? What I actually do is in our clinic, I run 3 flights of stairs with a patient with a pulse oximeter and see how they do. Do they desaturate? And if the history suggests there's some residual symptoms, and or if they desaturate, or if they had a big PE in the past, even if they have recovered, I get a cardiac echo to look for a right heart strain. The echo is not very sensitive to pick up a right heart strain and pulmonary hypertension, but it's still a non-interventional study. And if the patient really has significant leftover symptoms and clear desaturation, then I get a VQ scan to look for perfusion defects. And if then the perfusion defects are present, then I get the help of the pulmonologist. Now, the general practitioner, depending on how comfortable they are, they may order the VQ scan. And I wouldn't do that too early. I would clearly not do that within the first 3 months. And I actually don't like to do it before month 6 because people really improve over the next 6 months or so. But if the primary care physician is comfortable and at 6 months the patient still has significant symptoms, then a VQ scan can be ordered by them. If the VQ scan is normal, then the shortness of breath is not due to perfusion defects. And then you start to wonder about bronchospastic disease or some other interstitial lung disease and what have you. The one exemption where I do get a VQ scan and cardiac echo fairly routinely at 6 months is a patient who had a big PE, a central PE or really in the main pulmonary arteries. Even if they've recovered completely, I typically would obtain an echo and VQ scan, particularly in the young people, because the young people have a lot of ability to compensate for some lung damage. And they may still develop pulmonary hypertension where eventually pulmonary and arterectomy might be appropriate. So big PE at 6 months, I think about VQ scan and cardiac echo.
Fantastic. Thank you for going over that. And I think we are approaching the end of our time. There's much more we could talk about, but I was hoping each of you could share a few take-home points. Bill, I'll start with you from a pharmacy perspective, long-term management of VTE. What are the things you want our listeners to remember?
Yeah. So all DOACs, you know, you need to avoid carbamazepine, fosphenytoin, phenytoin, rifampin, St. John's wort. So that's across the board. You can just be straightforward. The other more complex situations, I think using interaction database is definitely should be utilized with chemotherapy drugs, seizure medications, HIV, and antifungal medications. definitely ask your patients about herbals and vitamins. It's very important, as Stefan brought up earlier. And then safe pain medications, Tylenol, Celebrex are good options for pain to treat the VTE. So those are my take-home points.
Great. Thank you. And Stefan, what about you? Some take-home points for our listeners.
First of all, the simple one, be clear that the patient really needs to be on long-term anticoagulation based on the recurrence triangle that we discussed. Secondly, make sure that the patient is not on aspirin, or if they are, that they really have a good indication to be on it. Thirdly, we've talked about the interruption at times of surgeries, not in the first 3 months, but okay after 3 months, and use the PAUSE trial as a good template for major bleeding risk, stop for 2 days prior, nothing on the day of. For minor bleeding risk, stop 1 day before and nothing on the day of, and then restart afterwards. And then post-thrombotic syndrome, we just discussed very recently the follow-up Doppler pelvic CT venogram to consider possible referral to vascular intervention radiology for angioplasty and stenting. And finally, after a big PE, or if the patient has residual pulmonary symptoms, a post-PE syndrome, good history, run 3 flights of stairs with a pulse oximeter, cardiac echo, and BQ scan.
Fantastic. So this concludes our discussion of the management and long-term sequelae of chronic VTE. A huge thank you to Stefan and Bill for talking with me today. I think this was a valuable discussion, very high yield for our listeners. On our next podcast, we're going to be talking about management of VTE in special populations. So some of those things that we touched on, high performance athletes, renal failure, obesity, you're not going to want to miss it. So please tune in and don't forget to complete your CE evaluation and claim your CE credit. And thank you for your attention.